Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners, all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. In today's seminar, our guest is Peter Rizzo, an editor at Bitcoin Magazine, editor-at-large at Kraken Cryptocurrency Exchange, and founding editor of the CoinDesk, one of the earliest publications in the Bitcoin space. Peter's been around Bitcoin and writing about Bitcoin for a few years, and in the last couple of weeks, he's published an interesting article called Against Cryptocurrency, the Ethical Argument for Bitcoin Only, in which he distills his years of experience in the cryptocurrency space in order to arrive at the conclusion of Bitcoin Only, which listeners will know that we are quite partial to as a conclusion. So he's arrived at it on his own, so I thought it would be interesting to discuss it, as well as some of the other interesting work that Peter has done over the years on Bitcoin. So, Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome to be here. Excited to discuss the work, and yeah.
All right, so can you give us a little rundown of, first of all, what is it that drove you to write this article? I mean, you can like Bitcoin without having to alienate people who like shitcoins, but why
go and, you know, stick your neck out to make this case?
Yeah, fair question, right? So I've been a Bitcoin and cryptocurrency journalist, I think since that term was invented in about 2013. And I've, you know, continued to engage with those groups, even as my personal outlook on the industry, technology, whatever your preferred nomenclature is, has changed. And I think there's a couple popular conceptions that have really been troubled me of late as I get deeper into understanding Bitcoin and spend more time studying it. One of them is that, you know, it's quote neutral or agnostic to just focus on cryptocurrencies, right? So I think that plenty of people will be aware that the mainstream media really focuses on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies as sort of this, you know, asset class, quote unquote, that they're all sort of stocks and bonds, that there isn't really much difference between any of them. They each have like a ticker letter and a number, and these just go up and down. And then this is something, you know, that is their default lens on the industry, right? So they sort of come to the conclusion that if you have a stance on Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, if you believe one of these systems is more viable, ethical, what have you, that is not neutral, right? So they have this assumed idea that one not having a position is neutral and that this is valuable. I think second, they have this perception that the cryptocurrency market is an effective mediator of cryptocurrencies, right? That it's giving them some sort of meaningful data about whether things are competing against Bitcoin or driving market share from Bitcoin. And I think most people from a Bitcoin maximalist perspective don't think that way at all, right? We don't engage with these types of systems. You know, we may have different outlooks to what they provide. So really, I think that's what I wanted to chip away at, right? Obviously, Forbes is a much different audience than other publications I've written for, being much more Bitcoin or crypto native. So I think, you know, really, I was keen to work with those editors to kind of put that out, because I do think that this default perception that it's neutral to just not have a position on cryptocurrencies just is really troubling, especially when you begin to consider them as systems that have different attitudes towards user rights, right? Or that they're designed in different ways, and that these different designs actually are fundamentally different for the users of the systems. So really, this was about calling attention to that and using that forum to put forward this argument that, you know, again, neutrality, whatever you want to call it, might not be as valuable as the mainstream currently thinks it is.
Yeah, and I think you know, it's entirely an issue of framing, and so this right. is kind of one of my pet peeves with journalism, and why I try and generally not read a lot of journalism, because you know this attempt to kind of manufacture neutrality and to present the journalist's work as if it is objective, truth-seeking, free from value judgments, is in itself, I think, the most powerful mechanism for imposing value judgments on the work. And I think on a societal scale, on a global scale, it's used to essentially impose a sense of narrative of what is acceptable, what is correct, what is not correct, what is beyond the pale, what is beyond acceptable. And so, you know, if you get to decide what is neutral and what is biased, then, you know, that's just another way of deciding what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, what is legitimate and what is not legitimate. And it's kind of a classic trick of modern journalism and modern propaganda. Well, if you excuse the redundancy in most cases, and that, you know, I know this, for instance, from the example of economics. You know, the majority of economists will not engage with the Austrian school, will not discuss Austrian school ideas, because they'll just tell you, what really matters here is, you know, this is a fringe opinion, but what really matters is the mainstream. And within the mainstream, here are the accepted viewpoints, and this is where all decent people stand. And if you're outside of that mainstream, then, you know, you're basically irrelevant to the discussion. Of course, all of that depends on how you define what is neutral. And right. In the case of digital currencies, one of which, you know, we're going to discuss the term and the problems we have with it. Right. One way that you could define it, one way you could think of neutrality, is that there are all these assets out there, and they're all competing for market share. And you, as a journalist or as somebody who's writing or somebody who's into this field, you know, the professional thing to do would be to maintain professional distance, just like if you were an investor, you know, you're very careful about how you talk about stocks. You know, just because you hold Apple or Netflix doesn't mean you spend all of your day in your office job or in your journalism job or in your, say, academic writing job, pumping the stock. Or at least you're not supposed to. So in this regard, you know, if you look at it this way, that there are all these assets and you're just picking one and you're not being neutral. I would argue that what's the only thing that's neutral in this is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the only thing that's a neutral protocol. And everything else is somebody's proprietary Excel sheet, basically. Everybody else is somebody's private spreadsheet. And you're... you know, you're buying entries in somebody's spreadsheet. And so if you want it to be neutral, you talk about Bitcoin. If you want it to be not neutral, you would talk about all these proprietary currency and spreadsheet projects.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, right? So I think that from a user rights perspective, Bitcoin is the most neutral. But when you look at a user rights perspective from cryptocurrencies, that's where you sort of run into problems. But I think that by and large, the journalism community, and I think many other communities, right? The business entrepreneur community is guilty of this. The investor community, you know, they've been very biased over the years towards a multi-cryptocurrency environment. So, you know, again, when I was really trying to establish this argument, I was also looking at, you know, what are the popular arguments for Bitcoin only? And many of these, you know, I've tried to kind of put these hats on over the years. I've looked at these arguments, you know, assessed how I feel about them. And I really kind of got to essentially that from my perspective, I think there's only essentially like four arguments for Bitcoin maximalism. One is sort of economic, right? It's the best money. You look at the properties of money and you can see that Bitcoin, you know, is the best on that metric. You can look at the network, right? It's the most decentralized by some sort of metric. You can look at the launch, right? There are conditions for Bitcoin that can't or won't repeat again. But the issue with some of those is that they're very comparative, right? So I think when we make arguments for Bitcoin on any of those basis points, it's not immediately clear to people why other cryptocurrencies aren't quite competing with Bitcoin in those areas, right? They may look at the cryptocurrency market as a way to validate that. Whereas from the user rights perspective, I think it's a lot more clear, right? I think Bitcoin is really the only system in which, you know, there is no majority that can collude to sort of rescind your rights, right? And I think there's been powerful arguments made by this from the mainstream. I think Alex Gladstein, Jimmy Song have done a great job of this argument. But I think the issue that I've had with that is essentially they only really go so far as to compare Bitcoin to fiat, right? So oftentimes when they're making sort of moral or ethical arguments for Bitcoin, it's saying that Bitcoin is a better system for ensuring rights than fiat. And I think the more complex argument is why is it a more ethical system for ensuring user rights as opposed to other cryptocurrencies? Because again, even when you make the worst cryptocurrency, you're copying a system that shares many of the same properties as Bitcoin, right? So I think one of the things that I wanted to do is, again, present this argument that I think has infiltrated and saturated the Bitcoin community that you know, Bitcoin is more moral, ethical, more neutral than fiat monies, right? But extend this to cryptocurrencies at large, because I think it's a more difficult argument. I understand the reasons why we haven't necessarily done that, right? There's a tendency to want to sort of ignore or pretend that other cryptocurrencies don't exist. But I actually argue that that's less helpful, right? So from the standpoint of journalism, business, VC, those types of interests, they often see our unwillingness to engage on that subject as a sign of intellectual weakness or passivity, right? So if you're just making an argument against fiat currency, most cryptocurrency industry VCs, business people, what have you, sure, they support that argument, right? They're also against the fiat system. They're also building an alternative. But anyway, so I think this goes back to the point that, you know, really, I guess the point of this piece was to take an argument, which I think we know really well, right? That we want to compare Bitcoin as a more neutral system to fiat, but also extend it to cryptocurrencies, which I think is a more difficult task.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world.
I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, and I think generally there's this idea that, you know, if you're into Bitcoin, then a lot of people seem to have this idea that you're obligated contractually to spend every waking minute listening to every person who has a pitch about a new coin and explaining to them why you prefer your Bitcoin to their coin. And unless you can convince them, then, you know, you're basically a coward who's running away from confrontation and conversation on this. And, you know, having been in this field for a while, you realize this is essentially a sales pitch that people use in order to get your attention. And effectively, digital currencies, I think the fundamental difference is, and to get back to your point on the ethics and the morality of it, ultimately, they are private currency schemes, and so they're owned by individual people, and they are controlled by a small group. I don't think any digital currency can credibly claim that the group of people behind it cannot change the consensus rules. I don't think there's a single cryptocurrency that can make that claim. So what you end up with is essentially people who just got together and made a currency, and now they're mining it and they're promoting it. Then it's as long as you don't have that reservation demand for people who want to hold it because they know it's neutral money, they can sit on it for 10 years and they'll know that their node and their private keys are going to work with the network, then, you know, you're engaging with somebody's own private, you could call it private currency, you could call it Ponzi scheme, whatever you want. I tend to think of them as being very similar to Ponzi schemes because there's no fundamental underlying demand. And what they market as the demand for it is that, you know, we're going to be able to use it for this or that or the other thing, which, you know, does not require you to hold it because you could just buy it when you need to use it, if that is the case.
Right.
So I think the you know, the issue of why we don't engage with altcoins is simply that engaging with altcoins is an advertisement for altcoins. And, you know, for people who are into Bitcoin, the reason that, you know, I like to block very liberally and indiscriminately on Twitter is because everybody who's promoting an altcoin, and a great way to promote your altcoin is to go to Bitcoiners, because that's a big group, the biggest group in digital currency. And go and talk about how great your altcoin is, because that's, you know, that's pretty fertile ground. Bitcoiners are already familiar with the basics of how a digital currency works. And so the pitch to the average Bitcoiner is a far, far higher chance, has a far higher chance of succeeding than the pitch to the average individual. And therefore, conversing with notable Bitcoiners and getting on Bitcoin forums is a great way to advertise in a digital currency. And that's ultimately what all of these discussions are. And so the reason that, you know, you don't engage, I don't like to engage a lot, is that, you know, that there's an infinite number of coins and there's an infinite number of people on Twitter who want to tell you about their coin. And I only have finite time on Earth, and spending it promoting those coins is not, it is not my idea of fun. And I think, you know, for me, my interest in Bitcoin in particular only came about when I understood that nobody can control Bitcoin. Before then, it was just a curiosity. When it got to that point, that's when it became interesting. And so none of the altcoins have gotten to that point yet where they could claim not to be controlled and not to be easy to hard fork and change consensus rules. And so that's why I think, you know, if you want to be neutral, you discuss the internet, but you don't discuss private companies on the internet. You know, you talk about the technology of the internet. And for me, the technology is Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, certainly there are very true aspects of what you just said, you know, including that a lot of these cryptocurrencies do have problems in terms of how centralized they are. I think, you know, what I try to do in this article a bit, and I received some criticism from Bitcoiners in this, is sort of make a steel man argument for cryptocurrencies, right? So I think oftentimes we sort of, again, sort of can appear like overly attack led and dismissive of these things, right? But what is the steel man argument for cryptocurrencies, right? If it is true that no one can control Bitcoin, then what is the alternative that the cryptocurrency system is proposing? And the closest that I can really get to charitably, and again, I like to emphasize charitably because I think it shows how weak the argument is if you actually look at it. I think in the best case scenario, I think what cryptocurrency, people who are agnostic to cryptocurrencies, what they believe is that cryptocurrencies should essentially be able to change in any way that's desired by the majority of users. And secondly, that this majority of people derived by the market should be able to make any decision up to including rescinding other people's rights. And I think this is where it gets sort of interesting, where you look at the cryptocurrency system is, okay, if that is true, right? If that is something that they broadly believe, right, that they're that they should have some sort of let's just be very charitable and call it democratic type decision making. How are you not?
That's not charitable, by the way. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're not being charitable by calling it democratic here. But yeah,
right. I understand. Yeah, you're a monarchy fan, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
But let's just, you know, again, be very charitable and say this is how these systems function, right? Where the majority of users can make any decision where they want, and then this becomes a moral or ethical decision. I think it becomes easier to see the issues with that, right? So I think, and I wrote in the piece, and I've been trying to sit with this and think about it, I think most cryptocurrency agnostics, what they end up arguing for is replacing government rights to money with the market's right over money, right? That you only have the right to your money in a cryptocurrency so long as the market will tolerate your right. And I think that's really interesting to look at on a flat surface, because if you're not okay with governments being able to rescind rights, why are you okay with markets being able to rescind rights? So what is the actual difference there? And I think that better highlights to me what is actually unique about Bitcoin, which is that, you know, there is no one who can rescind your rights. The protocol works absolutely, and it has a you have an irrevocable right to money within the Bitcoin system that I just think does not exist in other cryptocurrency systems. And I think once you sort of get that point across, you can start to chip away at some of these, you know, because again, as you were saying, the ultimate claim of most cryptocurrency proponents is that what they are doing is like Bitcoin, right? Ultimately, they want to establish in your head that there is that similarity. So I think for me, it sort of went down that path of, okay, steel man the argument. What is the most charitable way you can view this? Seeing the weakness with that sort of charitable presentation, again, why are you okay with the market being the vehicle by which user rights are now managed as opposed to governments? And what is the actual advance there? And then being able to put that sort of in an argument form of saying, okay, what is this other system that is other than Bitcoin trying to achieve?
Yeah, I think if I were to even be more charitable than you and kind of make an even more generous steel man, I'd say, yeah, there's nothing wrong with just letting the market have choice over money, because you have choice in the market. So let 10,000 currencies bloom. And, you know, if you like Bitcoin, if you like Litecoin, if you like BitConnect, you can get in on it. And then if you don't like it, you can sell it out. And, you know, if you make a good choice, get in early, and then people can get in after you, then you can sell out at a higher price. And that's just like any market speculation. So I guess you could say that, you know, why can't money just be another good provided by the market? And I don't have an objection to that. I don't think governments should ban altcoins. I don't think people should be thrown in jail for making altcoins. But that does not mean that I think that is workable as an economist. And I don't think it is moral. I think it's very blatantly exploiting this nascent new technology that allows this enormous increase in money transfer around the world. You know, the increase in the speed of money and the increase in the hardness of money, exploiting that in order to just essentially peddle Ponzi schemes that have no hope of capturing monetary premium. I think this is the key thing. Where Bitcoin is going, you know, Bitcoin can grow. Bitcoin's now currently around $1 trillion. Right. It can grow to $10 trillion. It can grow to $100 trillion. It can be held on the balance sheet of the largest institutions. It can be held by anybody anywhere in the world. And it can be held because of its monetary properties. You know, people hold it for as a cash balance. And there's a great article by Hans Hermann Hoppe called The Yield on Money Held Reconsidered, in which he makes the case, and this is heretic in modern mainstream economics, he makes the case that, you know, people hold money because of because it is a valuable thing. Having cash on hand protects you from uncertainty, allows you to take advantage of future opportunities. So there is value in having cash as opposed to having investments. And contrary to Keynesian propaganda, this isn't something pathological. It's the germ of all civilization. It's how all human savings and capital accumulation comes along. First, people save and they don't consume. And you know, saving money is the purest, most effective form of saving because money is the thing that is the most liquid in across time and across the future. So what Bitcoin allows us is a digital money. And it's a money that is, you know, it's a protocol. It's a set of rules without a ruler. It's a set of neutral protocols that can, and that anybody can log into and nobody can change. So what, you know, if Bitcoin didn't exist, then I would say that, yeah, then, and if altcoins was the only thing that we could do, you know, proprietary currencies on the private market, then I still wouldn't find them very interesting. But I think they would be a little bit they would be less illegitimate in my eyes because they're just competing with government. But of course, herein lies the problem. If Bitcoin did not exist, these currencies would not exist at all. I mean, the only reason I think they survive is because Bitcoin has made, first of all, the functional aspect available so that you can actually move money around the world with Bitcoin. And essentially, we can think of the entire cryptocurrency space as being a speculative asset built on top of Bitcoin. Ultimately, the final settlement happens with Bitcoin because, you know, Bitcoin is the only way that you can really know that you own something other than just somebody else's balance sheet. So functionally, it rides the coattails of Bitcoin because Bitcoin is what allows international settlement. And then I think politically and regulatory, it also rides the coattails of Bitcoin. If Bitcoin hadn't succeeded and survived for a few years and got it to a point where killing it was too complicated for any one particular government organization to undertake, or at least undertake successfully for all we know, once it got to that point, it became possible to launch all these other currencies. But I think the fact that Bitcoin exists as a neutral money means that anybody trying to offer you their own proprietary money is really just off trying to win trying to basically score seniorage. You know, the only reason that you would want to offer money when you would want to offer your own money when a neutral digital money exists is because you're looking into the seniorage. And if you look at all the digital currencies, you know, pretty much if you've heard about it, if it's in the top 10 at any point, if you have heard about it, if it's made it into the major cryptocurrency industry publications, it only managed to do that because it has a small, very efficient group of people that are running the code, they're doing the mining, they're managing the software upgrades, they're upgrading the nodes, they run the majority of the actual nodes that are on the network. And most importantly, of course, and that's where cryptocurrencies have excelled, the marketing. You know, there's a giant marketing machine behind every cryptocurrency that has made it anywhere. So you look at how it functions, you know, you may not have, I don't have a problem with privately competing monies. I don't think it would be an issue if people wanted to offer their own currencies. I mean, in a sense that I don't think it should be illegal, but I think it's very immoral, and I think It's been tried all throughout history where people have tried to pass off something as money, and it has always ended in disaster. And it always, you start off with people buying it, and then you end up with nobody wanting to hold on to it in the long run because it doesn't have that cash demand. Nobody wants to hold it as cash, and so everybody ends up dumping it in the long run. And the possibilities of digital technology mean that we can have these Ponzi schemes run for a very long time because we're starting from a very small place and we're spreading. But I think ultimately there's no scarcity to individual altcoins because there's nothing that guarantees that their supply can't be increased in case of increased demand. And then there's nothing to guarantee that the altcoins themselves, all of the supply of all of these, privately offered monies, and this is really the reason why this will fail the market test, is that the barrier to entry to making the next the next Bitcoin killer is very low. We've had thousands of people successfully market the next Bitcoin killer. So obviously not successfully enough to kill Bitcoin, but successfully enough for them to dump on retail suckers and to make a lot of money. And none of these, of course, is going to kill Bitcoin or kill each other. They are going to kill each other. They're just going to proliferate.
Yeah, I would say that breaking down what you said, maybe more from my personal view, I think most cryptocurrencies rely on a very finite series of comparative arguments. One, what they're doing is not Bitcoin, right? They want you to think that the technology is more expansive beyond what Bitcoin can do. So oftentimes they're using a more finite definition of Bitcoin. Again, I like to view Bitcoin as a financial system that can expand exponentially with, the development talent that is behind it. But oftentimes they're trying to get you to agree to a more finite definition of Bitcoin, whether it's digital gold or something like that. Because they are not Bitcoin, they're often using that as an excuse, I think, to take liberties with user rights, right? So they're sort of obfuscating that in order to have this great array of freedoms that they're offering you, right? They're saying, oh, you can use these sort of applications and all these sort of other things. But they're often, in the background, not really being clear that really comes with a restriction on you being able to do something within your system or sort of even retain your money, right? You can see a lot of the recent, decentralized finance hacks, right? These are essentially situations where, these centralized powers that are operating the systems will, recent example, make a decision to give out lots of money to people who then hold money. And then as soon as they decide that wasn't the decision that they wanted, those people no longer have any money, right? So you can kind of look at it as, within these systems, it's possible for some group of people to invalidate some user's right to money. So then the question is like, well, how does that happen, right? That has to happen some way because someone doesn't just lose access to their money without someone on the other end making a choice, right? And I would say maybe the another part to add on to that is that, oftentimes they're using the people of these who are promoting these cryptocurrencies, they're using the USD market for their cryptocurrency to justify their actions, right? So they're saying that because we took away these people's right to money, we chose to redistribute it and the market for our cryptocurrency went up. Therefore, it's good. It must have been a good thing that we did. Otherwise, people the price of our cryptocurrency would have gone down, right? So I think that you have to kind of look at the comparative arguments that are being made. And I think a lot of it is, what they're doing is not Bitcoin. Because it's not Bitcoin, we can put users in a situation where they have less rights. And then, we can then say that the cryptocurrency market validates us in some way.
Yeah. And this is, I think, this really puts us back into the crux of the argument about people offering private monies. I think, if people want to offer private monies, I think the reason this always fails and we always historically go back to gold as money, thousands of years we've had all kinds of governments and cranks and Keynesians and other kinds of crazy people mandate all kinds of crazy things as money. And then eventually that thing becomes worthless and we go back to gold because there is no value added in being a money printer. There is no value added in me being, come and get the money that is made by me. There's no product differentiation in a sense that here my money works better than Peter's money, because Peter's money, you know, is banana flavored, whereas mine is chocolate flavored. It doesn't work that way. There are no flavors to the issue. The only thing that you're looking for is saleability, is the ability to sell the money. And the only thing that proprietary money adds on is seniorage. That's the only addition. There's, functionally speaking, incidentally, I continue to say this, and I still fail to see a single counterexample. Functionally speaking, you look at everything that takes place in all the entire cryptocurrency market, and basically everything is private key, public key, and a ledger of coins. And you sign a transaction, and the ownership of the key of the coins moves from your keys to some other pair of keys, and that's it. And that's basically how they all work. But then there's a whole bunch of junk put on top in order to make it look like there's other things going on. And effectively, it's all kinds of different forms of financial engineering where, you know, you sign this and it gets locked up, and, you know, we lock it up, and then we get more people to lock up, and then the value goes up, and, you know, we pay interest on it. And so people think that they're earning interest, even though there's no actual work being done anywhere with any of these currencies. So ultimately, all that is taking place with money, you know, the only thing that money does is just move from person A to person B. That's the only thing that money can do. And the only thing that you can add by providing a private money is seniorage, which is something that is good for you, but it's not good for the consumers. And that's why on a free market, money always goes toward the free alternative, and by free I mean, you know, the one that is free of control, the one that is the market's choice, the one that has its value determined on the market.
Yeah, I definitely touch on that freedom of control, because I think the other thing that cryptocurrencies do is that they rely on misconceptions about Bitcoin's history and the nature of its control, right? So you'll see a lot of arguments, especially, you know, after I published this article, I think there are a lot of people within the Ethereum community, for example, who don't know that Bitcoin has chosen a path where we're not going to pursue hard forks as a technical change anymore, right? Or they'll make arguments that, oh, well, hard forks have changed in the past, have happened on Bitcoin in the past. Again, very debatable, probably not true. And to the extent that there were those cases, you know, they were made for, you know, the extreme emergency continuing of the protocol and not as a way to, you know, enact some new future and therefore, you know, remove the rights of some other users to money. So, you know, they sort of rely on misconceptions about the past. And I think, especially in my work, that's something I'd like to clarify, because I think, you know, some of those arguments are can be very compelling, right? Because Bitcoin itself is a very dense technology that has a very, you know, dense history to it. And I think a lot of those aspects haven't really been brought to light in a way that, you know, people can really understand. And again, so you have these second and third order misconceptions that build up over time, so that even you have somebody who's working on the Ethereum protocol who doesn't even really have any, you know, real historical understanding of what has happened in Bitcoin. You know, I think you're a casual observer at this point, you should be able to understand that basics about Bitcoin's development roadmap and how it functions, right? Especially if you're building some sort of other system.
Yeah, and I think perhaps we should do a little bit of a recap of some of the greatest hits of what makes Bitcoin Bitcoin and different from all the others. So I think if I were to maybe specify it with one technical metric, it is that Bitcoin is the only one that is today, you know, the latest block that just cleared right now is back. You could mine that block, and you could sync your node up to this block using the code that was the original specification that was introduced by Satoshi. So Satoshi's code, if you try to run it today, it's slow, it's inefficient, it has a bunch of bugs, and it's not great, but it still syncs with the blockchain up until today. So the consensus parameters of the Genesis block are still compatible with the consensus parameters of the last block that we just had, 700,000 and something.
Right.
This is an enormous point of distinction between Bitcoin and the other cryptos. Well, I shouldn't say the other cryptos, between Bitcoin and the unregistered security industry that calls itself digital currencies, is that the consensus parameters in all of these altcoins are trivial to change. And most of them change a lot of things very regularly. And they'll change them, and they take pride in the fact that they change them because they don't even see the value in immutability. They think there's value in flexibility. And I think here there's the idea is that you're going to be doing all these apps. We've heard about so many apps that are going to be built on decentralized networks, and yet none have achieved commercial viability. So we've heard about so many prediction markets with, you know, their own tokens, and these, you know, their tokens were worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars at certain points. You've heard about all kinds of different supposed apps and products that are going to be built, but ultimately, none of these apps really requires the level of decentralization that Bitcoin has. And all of these apps are de facto centralized when they're on another digital currency. And all that you're doing is that you're just paying many, many, many millions of multiples the cost that you would get if you were using a more efficient centralized solution like AWS, which is essentially what you're doing when you're using one of the altcoins, because most nodes are run on AWS anyway. And so you're already, AWS is already a choke point. It's already a central point of failure. And if you're using AWS, Amazon Web Services, if you're using them directly, well, you're cutting out one middleman of the team of developers that are just there. And you're saving, you know, a millionth. You're paying something like a millionth of the cost, because, you know, it's much more efficient when you're running it on centralized computers rather than many, many decentralized computers. You know, there's no reason for thousands of computers worldwide to have to register your prediction market bet about who's going to win the next election or the next World Cup or whatever. These things can be done much more efficiently and effectively, and they are being done. You know, the centralized betting market around the world is worth, I don't know, tens of billions, maybe even hundreds of billions. If you think about sports betting online and all that stuff, it's an enormous market. And, you know, as usual with blockchain, it's a solution looking for a problem. You know, the betting industry is doing fine as it is. It doesn't need all of this decentralized nonsense in order to function. So basically you're compromising the immutability in search of novelty. And I think the contention that I make is that, you know, if you want novelty, just go use AWS. It's as decentralized and much more efficient and much faster.
I think my only point with this type of argument, though, is that I both agree with you, but think that it's highly easy to dismiss, right? I think this is one of those things where, speaking back to the Bitcoin maximalist arguments, I think we've argued a lot that the Bitcoin network is the most centralized. We've presented a lot of data for why that's correct. And there were even recently, I think Only the Strong Survive was a great example, really lengthy papers about how Bitcoin decentralization compares to the lack of centralization in different cryptocurrencies. But again, I feel like it doesn't really kind of get to the inherent divide here so much, because I think that one of the issues with this is still that from the cryptocurrency agnostic crowd, right, there are still, the way that the cryptocurrency market functions appears to at least give these, you know, so you're saying, you know, okay, Bitcoin is the most decentralized. The cryptocurrency agnostic, I think, argument to that is to look at the cryptocurrency market itself and say, okay, well, your opinion isn't valid because clearly the market is validating it. Clearly, the market has given some value to this product. And I think that's sort of where it gets easy to refute these kind of arguments, where, you know, I'm not sure if you're someone who's biased generally to the fact that the cryptocurrency market is providing you with usable data, I think you're going to end up disagreeing with that argument. Because and it's not a matter of whether the arguments are true. It's just it's a matter of framing, right? If you fundamentally believe that the cryptocurrency market is valuing projects and giving you some meaningful data about those projects, you're going to listen to an argument that Bitcoiners are going to make about network decentralization, and you're going to weigh it against this other thing. Where I think one of the interesting things for me when I'm trying to just parse out, okay, what is it that Bitcoin maximalists believe and what is it that cryptocurrency agnostics believe, and just kind of thinking about them as two different sets, right? I think that for Bitcoin people, and again, I'm curious to hear what you think of this claim. I think that for us, the definition of a neutral non-state monetary system, it exists within the domains of economics and computer science. It's not something that we look to the cryptocurrency market to validate. We're not looking at websites like CoinMarketCap or Messari every day and gaining some sort of understanding from it about our performance. In most cases, we're completely discarding that information. But again, kind of going back to the original part of this argument, I think when we're making arguments for Bitcoin maximalism, we do have to be conscious of this framing, because I think in some respects, no matter how well we can debate some arguments, they're going to be discarded from people who are coming from this neutral perspective. Because again, a problem of lens, a problem of framing, which is why I continue to kind of go back to this idea of, I think Bitcoin maximalism, we've been very successful on the user rights argument. That does seem something that is innately appealing to people, because it's very hard to be against people's rights and freedoms. It's a very unpopular position to take. And in the case of journalism, the inherent claim of most journalists is that they're supposed to be biased towards human rights and freedoms, right? So I think the question to ask to these sort of groups who have become disengaged by these arguments, again, it's not that they're wrong. An argument can be both 100% correct and not appealing to someone, right? And I think that's the case with some of these arguments about how decentralized Bitcoin is. It's not that Bitcoin isn't the most decentralized. It is. But I think you have to kind of take another step to sort of bend that framing to the person. It is the most decentralized, therefore it is the best at ensuring user rights. Therefore, all these other systems are actually systems that offer people weaker user rights that actually don't protect those freedoms. So therefore, again, it's not neutral for you to hold your position that these other systems are competing against Bitcoin or they're good for whatever reason. They're just inherently different from this perspective. So again, I always kind of go back to it from this lens perspective, because again, speaking for myself, I was a member of the journalist class, right? I understand how that group looks at things, and I understand how they can be dismissive of things. And I think it's just safe to say at this point that the arguments we're making there, they're not penetrating very well. And for whatever reason, right? It may be that it doesn't, we can both be right and unsuccessful at making a case to somebody, I think is my point. And I think what the intent with this article was to sort of take some of these arguments that I do think are very correct, but maybe just sort of reframe them in a certain way. Because I don't think that the argument that Bitcoin is the most decentralized, other cryptocurrencies mostly run on AWS, I think that argument can be a little bit complex, whereas Bitcoin is the most centralized, you have the most freedoms, your freedoms are absolutely guaranteed. And in every other cryptocurrency, your freedoms are actually subject to what your peers or what this market or what the small group of people think. Yeah. Right? I think they're both inherently true for the same reasons. It's just one goes that extra step of sort of saying, here's why this actually matters to you, right? And I think that I don't know. This is just something that I wanted to point out in putting forward this argument is that I do think Bitcoin maximalists, and I think Udi Werthermeyer has done a lot of criticism recently of Bitcoin maximalism, some popular, some not, has been cognizant of this as well. I think we should always be trying to make our arguments better, because our argumentation, I think, is important. We can be right, and maybe time will prove us right. And maybe none of this matters. But I don't know. It's still an exercise that I like to aspire to.
Yeah. No, I think the way that I usually present this issue of decentralization is kind of more in agreement with what you said, in that I the way I put it is that with Bitcoin only has users. Bitcoin has only had the users since Satoshi disappeared. And Satoshi's been gone for more than 10 years now. And that's perhaps a good segue into the other piece of yours that we wanted to discuss. So Satoshi's been gone for 10 years, and Bitcoin throughout those 10 years has continuously, repeatedly, successfully caused massive emotional damage to people who thought they could hard fork it or change it. Mm. I mean, it's just been an absolute wonder to watch as one ego after another shatter like a little flimsy boat of... Yeah. Made out of little wooden sticks on massive rocky shores with heavy waves smashing it into pieces. This is kind of what we've been seeing. And of course, the most notable and the most important one is in November 2017. I think this is really the point that explains the difference. This isn't a popularity contest, and I'm not out here to get points. And as you said, I don't care about what happens on CoinMarketCap or what shitcoin Twitter is saying and what shitcoin influencers are, you know, what they think is cool in their local coin of the week competitions. Ultimately, I think the real thing is what really matters, and I think this is what you see has been a message that has penetrated very successfully with extremely successful investors and high net worth individuals. You know, people like Paul Tudor Jones, Bill Miller, Michael Saylor, obviously, Ross Stevens. They get this point, and this is why they can go to their, you know, to their staff and to their investors and to their boards, and to tell them Bitcoin is a technology. It is not a company. We're not inventing behind. We're not inventing in a small team of weirdos. We're inventing in a protocol, in a software, and we know that because, as I was saying earlier, 2017 when we had the SegWit 2x hard fork attempt. And I think this is an enormously important chapter in Bitcoin's history, the block size war. And this is, you know, we could argue about technical specifications, as you said, and numerical metrics, but all of that stuff is like arguing about whose ship is better when we are all docked at port. Doesn't matter. You know, we can argue about whose paint job is nicer and whose aerodynamic design is slicker. But at the end of the day, when the storm comes, that's what matters. Can your boat survive the storm? And Bitcoin has been through the storm. Yeah. Now, the other altcoins have not even, well, I mean, a lot of them have been through their own storm. And I think this is the kind of thing that a lot of shitcoin apologists miss, which is there's 10,000 shitcoins, and so if you pick the best performing ones, you can find periods where the best performers have beaten Bitcoin. But for the vast majority of shitcoin investors, you know, the money lost in BitConnect and Aurora Coin and in all these failed projects and all the Ponzi schemes, that's where a lot of money has been lost. And, you know, the people who lost that money don't go on social media and talk about it. They've moved on with their lives, or they're too ashamed to mention it. You know, when the storm comes, when the team in charge wants to take control, with BitConnect, we saw what happened. You know, one day they just printed a whole bunch of tokens, sent it to the exchange, cashed out, and the coin went practically to zero, and everybody who was holding the coin was left with nothing. With Bitcoin, you know, they didn't even try and print new tokens. All that they did was try and change the block size. And, you know, we had the manufacturer of the majority of the hash rate. We had the majority of the hash rate, the owners of the majority of the hash rate, the mining pools, the majority of the mining pools. We had basically all the biggest Bitcoin businesses, or at least the vast majority of big Bitcoin businesses, exchanges, almost all major Bitcoin exchanges internationally in China, back when we had exchanges in China, in China and Europe and in the US, all of them got together. A lot of core developers, a lot of the most important developers and public figures of Bitcoin, you know, Gavin Anderson in 2015 or 2014, I think it was, the Financial Times had said something along the lines that he's arguably been more important for Bitcoin than Satoshi Nakamoto. And for a while in 2013, 14, 15, this was a pretty common take, you know, if you know, the responsible people who are neutral on these issues understood and accepted that, you know, Gavin Anderson was more important than Satoshi. And Gavin Anderson was lined up behind SegWit2x. Roger Ver, one of the earliest Bitcoiners, Bitcoin Jesus, he was also behind it. And he had a massive support of people behind it. And yet all of those people failed to change the consensus parameters. And this is where it's different. So this is why, you know, there's a very different quality of the money that goes into Bitcoin and goes into shitcoins. With Bitcoin, you know, you see serious investors and serious institutional money coming in. With shitcoins, you have people who are gambling, essentially, and they're looking to make a quick buck. And, you know, you don't have people doing proper due diligence in institutional investors that have arrived at the conclusion that, you know, putting all this money in a multi-billion dollar project that's run by a bunch of coders with no experience with finance or with even running successful coding projects is a good idea. And the reason is, ultimately, you know, as I was saying earlier, with Bitcoin, everybody is a user. With altcoins, you're a user and there's an admin. And, you know, the admin is, they can do anything. I think, you know, think of the model of Google or Amazon or Facebook. You're a user of Facebook, but there are admins. And, you know, you cross the line. There are several lines and the lines keep increasing now. You do something wrong on Facebook, you get removed from the platform. That's it. You can't use Facebook anymore. It's like that with Amazon. It's like that with Google. It's like that with altcoins to an extent. We've seen many altcoins do things like this over the years. They'll reverse the blockchain, as they famously did during the DAO hack. So they'll reverse the blockchain in order to stop you from using it according to the criteria that are there. And right. That's I think, really the... That's kind of the kind of, you know, the test of the question of decentralization in a way that is practical.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, certainly I've, you know, part of my work is doing archival research on, you know, some of the events in Bitcoin history. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the fork wars, because that's sort of where my own journey towards Bitcoin maximalism started, right? I was a journalist confronted with, you know, the sort of warring groups between Bitcoin, right? Everyone had this different ideas of what Bitcoin should be. A couple points I would comment on that. I think, you know, one is that is just evidence of, I think, how influential your work has been. Is one, I think back then there wasn't really that much understanding of the economics of Bitcoin, right? It was still early. We'd only been through sort of one halving. And I think a lot of the developers and people in Bitcoin, you know, certainly now benefit from a hindsight that didn't exist then, right? You had a lot of people who think were approaching Bitcoin as a technology, right? And they saw Bitcoin as being something that was fundamentally benefiting from their human efforts rather than the quality of the programming. So I think you mentioned the story that I did on, you know, sort of looking into what happened when Satoshi disappeared. I think that was an attempt to sort of look at, okay, what do we actually know about how Satoshi ran the project? What can we infer from his time as maintainer? How did user attitudes towards him switch over time? And how did developer attitudes change? Ultimately, I was able to get a lot out of that, because you were able to kind of see that, you know, even in Satoshi's time, there was a growing understanding that, you know, there shouldn't be someone in charge, that users controlled the protocol. And ultimately, the sort of towards the end of the article sort of ends with, you know, Satoshi was challenged during his own time as maintainer, right? Like he did decide to take actions that were met with critical user feedback. And in a few instances, even, or in one particular instance, that, you know, there was even an actual attempt to reverse one of his changes, right? So I think, you know, if you look at the Bitcoin users were early on really quick to identify that this was a tool for managing their rights, right, against all others, including the people who are pushing out the code. There are some interesting like comments from that time in that article that I dig out, where, you know, people really did see themselves as being in charge of Bitcoin and Satoshi as being secondary, up until the point where I really think that, you know, towards the end of Satoshi's time in the project, there was sort of a clamoring to sort of move beyond him, because I think that the users collectively were keen to sort of exercise their power and to do different things and do new things and to kind of move beyond, you know, what even he thought was possible. But yes, I think you're right. That does end up metastasizing in, you know, different groups of people who didn't maybe have the backgrounds and specialties to lead this project. You know, that sentiment then spilled out into other cryptocurrencies. You mentioned the DAO fork, you know, the hard fork of Ethereum cryptocurrency. Again, something that I think a lot of proponents of alternative cryptocurrencies will try to sweep under the rug, but a very formative time in the history of not just Bitcoin, but all cryptocurrencies. This was an incident where, you know, you had a group of developers that, again, you know, sort of agreed to ask the community whether it was okay to rescind the rights of a user, right? So in the DAO hack example, an individual used a smart contract. That smart contract happened to contain a massive amount of Ethereum that a lot of big people owned. And there was such a clamor that eventually the developers were sort of asked, you know, should we change the protocol, you know, to undo this hack, right? And I think even then, if I remember at the time, a lot of the discussion was framed over, was there wasn't like a weighting that I would put on the framing at that time, right? There was a lot about, well, what does the market want? What do people want? And there was very little discussion about, okay, is it ever okay for someone to invalidate someone else's rights, And I think that's how the Bitcoin community largely looked at that schism, right? So you can kind of go back to the dev fork and see that the Ethereum community sort of thought that this was a, you know, test that they could, you know, put to the market. They said, you know, okay, this individual acted badly. Let's ask the market to decide whether or not he should still have access to his money. The market decided to rescind that, right? Within Bitcoin, I think there was a strong recognition, again, of this moral hazard, right? If you ultimately put the market in such a place where it's going to adjudicate user rights, right? You know, are you actually providing a mathematical guarantee? So I think out of that, you have some interesting kind of formative arguments kind of developed for Bitcoin. A couple that I think that are interesting, they're put forward by Adam Back. One is that Bitcoin is a mathematical guarantee. The other one is that Bitcoin is apolitical money, right? That it is money where you cannot be coerced, you know, by anyone in order to lose that money. And then even on top of that, any grouping of political actors shouldn't be able to then force you to do anything. So I think you get out of that whole period, kind of bringing it back to the theme of this conversation with his user rights. I think within Bitcoin, the only way that I can articulate it is I think you have the right to dissent in Bitcoin. In Bitcoin, you have the right to reject a decision that the majority wants to enforce. In Bitcoin, it's still possible for you to build coalitions that in some way, I think, resemble political actors, right? So a good example would be the most recent soft fork for Bitcoin that's upcoming, Taproot. Many Bitcoiners want those advantages. Many Bitcoiners want to use those additional smart contracting features. They were able to build a lot of support for that. Ultimately, that support was, you know, put in a flag in the software about whether people should update it to that new code. Yet, we still live in a time in Bitcoin where if you're part of the minority that wants to not use Taproot, no one is forcing you. Your Bitcoin will still be Bitcoin. There is no decision that you can make within Bitcoin where you will not have access to your money anymore. Most other cryptocurrencies, again, going back to the historical examples, look at that situation and they believe that it's okay in those conditions where you do not want to be coerced by the majority for you to then lose your rights. But I think the way that you would articulate is that they force you to appeal to the market for rights. So in the instance of the DAO fork, what happened was, you know, someone's rights were invalidated. They appealed to the market and said, I would like to continue having my money. Ethereum Classic was born, right? A whole market activity had to come together to support another network with these user rights. So I think you end up with the question that I would get at, which is in other cryptocurrencies, if you don't have the right to dissent, if you don't have that right, well, what is the outcome? The outcome is that if you do dissent, you are punished. There is a cost imposed on you as a human being continuing to have your rights. And again, I think this is a really crucial distinction because again, in Bitcoin, we do seem to have this right to dissent. And so as much as we want to praise, you know, technical upgrades like SegWit or Taproot, you know, I think we have to even more broadly celebrate that within Bitcoin, you still have the right not to use these features if you don't want to. And I think that is a feature that we only see in Bitcoin and almost doesn't exist anywhere else in the cryptocurrency community.
Absolutely. And I think this is this touches on a deeper philosophical and political point that you mentioned in your article, which is that altcoins are essentially majority rule, whereas I would say Bitcoin is consensual. Bitcoin is based on consent. And so
right.
you download the software client and you buy the coins and you move them to your address. If you'll excuse the expression, that's not exactly how Bitcoin works, but you know, as a figure of speech, you buy the coins and you download the code and that's it. You know, that's your node. These are your coins and that network will be there. And we have very strong certainty that nobody can force you to do anything you don't want. You know, you could,
right.
There are people who have held Bitcoin for 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, they bought it, they put it on a wallet and 10 years
if
on.
If you don't go into a coma tomorrow, you know.
Yeah, the coins are still there. They're still working. And you come out 20 years later from your coma, the coins will still be there and the consensus parameters will be there. I think this for me is what makes Bitcoin interesting, because without this, then it's just, you're just running a private database. You're playing with pretend coins on somebody else's database. And I think the reason why this isn't, this really makes no sense, why the coins only really offer seniorage is that, in the digital world, you know, the marginal cost of making an extra unit of money is zero. You know, if you can hard fork a digital currency, you can 10x the supply with one line of code. You know, we made a hard fork and whoops, we've gotten, you know, we don't have 21 million Bitcoins now. We have 210 million Bitcoins and 180 million of these are in my wallet or, you know, my wallet and the wallet of my friends who helped me, you know, run this decentralized system. So the entire value can disappear. And if you don't have this guarantee of immutability, then you don't have anything. You just have a wild speculative bubble at a time of very easy money, at a time when, you know, when lumber prices can shoot up and the price of everything is going up and everybody's speculating and GameStop and Robinhood and all of that stuff. You have these speculative bubbles blowing up, but in the long run, you know, they're built on very flimsy foundations. But, you know, I don't begrudge anybody the chance to go and dabble. They can knock themselves out.
I think I've been trying to rephrase. It's interesting because you're saying about the seniorage, you know, argument of, you know, it's just easy to print money. I think the way that I would maybe try to articulate that a bit differently is that I think within Bitcoin, you have the right to a known money supply. You have the right to a predictable issuance of that supply, and you have the right to compete for that issuance. And I think, again, that's sort of taking an economic argument and flipping on its head a little bit where, you know, okay, if you look at the Bitcoin list of rights, right, you know, you've got the irrevocable right to money. You have this right to dissent from the majority. Now it's you have the right to a known money supply. You have the right to a predictable issuance. You have the right to compete to that issuance. And then you sort of look at the other cryptocurrencies and say, okay, do they offer irrevocable right to money? I would argue, you know, as you alluded to, because they function via hard fork and political decree, essentially, no. Do they offer the ability, a right to a dissent? No. Again, for the reasons just explained. And do they offer the right to a known money supply or predictable issuance and for you to compete for that issuance? I think also no. But I think, you know, again, that argument sort of maybe speaks a little bit to the impact of the user, right? If you have a choice to join a system where you know the money supply, you know the issuance, you know that you can compete for it if you want, right? You know, there might be a cost, but you can. You know, are you going to join that system or are you going to join a system where you don't have the right to know the money supply? You don't have the right to the issuance. That is also subject to political change, right? The money supply and the issuance and your ability to compete for that issuance might also be subject to political change, right? So I think that's a way to maybe kind of flip it on its head and sort of say, you know, one of the qualities of these cryptocurrencies other than Bitcoin seems to be that they function by this. And again, this is why I say it's obfuscated, because they claim to be decentralized, but when you look at the decision-making process, it functions via building political coalition. At the very least, like, it has to function that way, because again, something has to be deciding on these decisions, right? And there has to be some, you know, and the more there is a decision to be made, the more there is an influence on that process of the decision, which again is what sort of gives rise to this, I think, theme that we're talking about here, which is that, you know, other cryptocurrencies, one, are seem to be inherently political, but two, because they're inherently political, they're more, you know, they're less able to confidently secure user rights, right? I don't know how you would make the argument that they actually, you know, do that. And if they don't do that, how are they not different than Bitcoin, right? I think that's coming back to where we started, where it's, you know, getting rid of this neutrality argument. If they are cleanly and clearly different from the subject of the users who are entering the systems, we need to stop considering them as being the same thing, right? And I think most Bitcoiners, I think, you know, would agree that, you know, I think it's, you know, I want to see Bitcoin kind of taken out of this, you know, neutrality argument here, right? Where things are just sort of seen as this is this crypto asset class market. All these crypto assets are the same. And I think that's maybe how we chip away at it.
Yeah. I think it's, I think that's a good point. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit more about your work on Satoshi. What is the what are your perspectives on Satoshi? You've studied closely his writings, What do you think of his contribution to Bitcoin? And in particular, I'm curious about one aspect of things. This might be a little bit of an unpopular opinion I have, which is probably Satoshi was maybe not necessarily looking to build the Bitcoin that we have today. I think, yeah. I think in my mind, you know, and I think that a lot of the people that sympathize with my views on Bitcoin would like to think that Satoshi was some Austrian economics nerd who had studied money and gold for many years, right, and then went out and built an alternative for gold. And while I think, you know, that there is definitely an element of libertarian thought in his ideas, he does have an element of being anti-government and being for freedom. It occurs to me that the Austrian aspect of Satoshi's design was the product of good engineering rather than familiarity with Austrian economics. In other words, he built a money that somebody like Rothbard would have approved of, not because he read Rothbard and he wanted to build the perfect money, but because he was a very smart engineer who looked at the issue of money and tried to figure out a design for how to make this thing work. And, you know, it clearly made sense to him, as any engineer would, that, you know, you don't need more tokens. You can, you don't need the token supply to continue to increase indefinitely. And in fact, it's more desirable for the supply to be fixed so that the network can have, full traceability of, full auditability of all transactions so that we can know that nobody is cheating. And so, even though I should probably be trying to talk up the other aspect of him, trying to portray him as, you know, this just another hero Austrian economist like me who's out there to save the world. I think, you know, he's not an Austrian economist. He's a coder. He's a programmer. He may have had a functional need for Bitcoin for his business or whatever. But the kind of design parameters that he arrived at, I don't think they were motivated by a very thorough study of economics, in as much as he arrived at the correct principles because he just thought about it from first principles.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, I did spend a lot of time earlier last year just sort of diving into the Satoshi archives for a piece that I wrote on the 10th anniversary of his disappearance, right? And I do think it's important to take a, you know, look at what we can know of Satoshi, right? Because there are certainly many things that we cannot know about Satoshi. So I think, you know, to me, I've always wanted to strive to understand the things we can know. So I'd say, first off, there are some very remarkable things about Satoshi generally that probably don't get enough, discussion. One that I think, you know, first off, and I think this is kind of something that I've really only kind of gained an appreciation with time, it's really crazy that Satoshi never priced or sold Bitcoin, that these were free market activities that sort of were encouraged as part of the system, but that he never personally did that, right? We actually only know of maybe one or two transactions that he ever sent with individuals. But again, I think the fact that he let the economy emerge organically, like, is a real testament of will, because I think one of the things that's kind of interesting is you look at the first year of the Bitcoin project, there really isn't a lot that happens, right? Satoshi sort of releases the software on a forum mailing list. There's some initial excitement, but there's this really dead period in 2009 where, you know, you can look at the transactions day by day, and it's like some days there's whole months where the number of days is larger than the number of transactions in that entire month, right? So the Bitcoin network immediately it's not a roaring success, right? But Satoshi is interesting because I think you can also look at him as an entrepreneur, right? Satoshi was willing and interested in doing things to promote Bitcoin, and therefore he had to take a different attitude to the project, right? So one of the things that he does that's really formative at the beginning is he builds the Bitcoin forums. He builds a place for people to talk about Bitcoin. And this is where I think a lot of the activity really starts, where once people kind of get together, they understand the idea, they start to price and trade Bitcoin and develop the Bitcoin economy. So that is a result of Satoshi, but I think it's interesting, again, that he chose to let that happen organically, right? So I think that's one thing that I would say for him initially, is that really that first period is, I think, one remarkable for its just sheer perseverance, right? Just the fact that he knew that he had created this thing, right? And I think that's the other thing, you can look at his early writings, especially his comments on the P2P Foundation Forum. You know, he understands Bitcoin as an alternative to central banking. He may not say it in those express words, but he appears extremely confident in the system. And I think in a lot of respects, knows that it should work. So I think for someone to have the patience and resolve to wait an entire year before any other human being prices the currency that you've created, it shows a lot of confidence, right? You have to have a lot of willpower. I know that even as someone who creates things, you know, you publish something online, you want that response from people, right? If it doesn't come, you might go in your hole and, you know, just sort of, you know, do the next thing, right? But Satoshi did endure through a lot of period where you would say that Bitcoin was not an overwhelming success. Yes, the network had hash rate, people were mining coins, but in a lot of respects, it was, you know, was a nothing burger, right? There wasn't too much going on. So I think that's one first part I would say about Satoshi. I think the second part that you're absolutely right on is that I don't think Satoshi was an Austrian economist. I think that he arrived at the design for Bitcoin through an engineering need. And I think that in a lot of respects, I think another thing that you said is very true is that I don't think Satoshi, the Bitcoin that we have today, I don't view as being entirely the product of Satoshi. So one of the things that I'm really interested in exploring through my archival research is sort of this question of how does Bitcoin become Bitcoin? Certainly a large portion of that is owed to Satoshi. But I do think he leaves the other developers with really important unanswered questions that without which us having an answer, Bitcoin could have ended up radically different in how it was constructed, right? So I think one of the things that you can look at through this article and it sort of traces is Satoshi's more non-traditional outlooks and behaviors, right? Things that Satoshi does today that we probably would have thought would be odd or like, you know, behavior that we wouldn't necessarily encourage, right? So he does over, you know, a period in 2010, you know, start to open up the project development, more people begin to collaborate with him. And then what happens is that there's essentially this big exploitation of the code, right? There's someone who figures out how to subvert his coding and print a bunch of Bitcoin within the blockchain. He ultimately rolls back that change. But he really becomes someone who, you can look at the later period of Satoshi, who moves very quickly to enact things unilaterally, right? With maybe without the sort of review and the process that we have today, right? Where if I was to sort of going back to the theme of user rights in this conversation, you know, go back to that kind of standpoint, I would say that today we accept that everybody within the Bitcoin system has the right to review and propose code. And in Satoshi's time, I'm not sure that that was true. Satoshi oftentimes didn't publish his code. He would, you know, for review and to the extent that he needed users to upgrade would just kind of push that code unilaterally. So I don't think that Satoshi was quite aware of the moral hazard of him, right? I don't think he understood maybe as much as later users that I sort of pose this question as, you know, at the standpoint where Satoshi creates Bitcoin, does it really exist? Can a single human being create a decentralized money? Is that possible or is it an inherent contradiction? And I think it is sort of an inherent contradiction. At the point that Satoshi is the only Bitcoin user, I don't think Bitcoin actually exists. Like it can't because it's not decentralized. So I think with Satoshi, you sort of have the sense of, I don't know how much Satoshi was cognizant of his own authority. So therefore, he never really leaves behind a blueprint, I think, of one, how Bitcoin should be managed, and then how Bitcoin should be upgraded into the future. Because again, he is someone who shows that he wants to take, you know, and because again, within open source software, this was generally how open source projects were managed. They had a strong sort of maintainer dictator who was able to sort of move unilaterally because he was viewed as the owner of the product, right, or the project. And Bitcoin, obviously, that relationship undermines the value proposition of Bitcoin because you can't have someone who owns that project, right? Bitcoin's supposed to be a neutral monetary system, right? The fact that there is a individual person who can exert that much authority is an inherent moral hazard. So I think, you know, because of that, Satoshi is someone we can only really look to for so much because I don't think Satoshi ever really figured out how Bitcoin would exist beyond him. And I think to the extent that he was, you know, if you can look at his time as developer, I think that he shows sort of a weakness in understanding these types of changes, right? A classic example would be in response to his, the question, you know, so one of the developers sort of codes up a question and says, what if we do want to increase the block size? And I don't think he's even advocating for it at that point. He's just saying like, okay, what if we have a change that's incompatible with consensus, like, what do we want to do with that? And so she's like, oh, well, we can always upgrade it later if we need to. Right. So he sort of leaves these sort of passages where, you know, he is deliberately vague. And I think you sort of actually have to look at that as a deliberately vague answer because Satoshi is so specific, right? He's not someone who, as I'm doing in this response, like, you know, leaves a lot of words about what he's doing, right? He's oftentimes very succinct. into the point. So I guess I would say to the whole of the conversation, I think, yes, Satoshi is someone who is very important to Bitcoin too. I don't think he is someone I consider as Bitcoin's full creator. I do think there were a lot of other participants to completing Bitcoin. I think in a lot of respects, he left a very unfinished product, partly because I don't think he ever really had to consider his relationship with the thing itself. And that as time goes on, that becomes the most problematic part. And I think a lot of other cryptocurrencies sort of, again, they attracted people who were less keen to like think about that process and the inherent moral hazards that came from having someone who had authority over the product.
Yeah, I think I generally agree with you on a few things, but I kind of see it a little bit differently, slightly, in that I think, because as I mentioned earlier, his software implementation is still compatible today. So I think the Bitcoin that we have is Satoshi's Bitcoin. Where I think it has grown into something different from Satoshi's Bitcoin is in the kind of the social aspect of it and the way that it is used. In other words, you know, the knife is still a knife, but it used to be used, say, for fighting. Now people use it for cooking as well. I think it is still the same Bitcoin, but I think what I was trying to get at, in my opinion, is similar to kind of what you were arriving at. But I think I don't think, let me put it this way. I think the second most important thing Satoshi did for Bitcoin was his disappearance. You know, he invented Bitcoin. That's number one. Number two was that he disappeared. And I think it's not so much that it was Satoshi's genius that made Bitcoin decentralized or a specific plan of his. I think it was his disappearance. And I struggle to think that he just disappeared voluntarily. I think he is probably dead or incapacitated in some way and unable to join and participate in the network. But, you know, whatever the situation is, I think the cherry on top, or more than just the cherry on top, like the magic sauce that makes Bitcoin work, the glue that holds the puzzle pieces together on the wall, is the fact that Satoshi disappeared and then Bitcoin basically had to grow. And I made a famous metaphor in a talk once that went viral, which is Bitcoin was like Tarzan thrown in the jungle as a kid. Most likely not going to survive without adult supervision. But if it does survive, it's going to be a very, very strong monster. So I think it was his disappearance really that gave us the decentralized Bitcoin. And I think if he had stuck around, I don't think he would have resisted the temptation to become the single point of failure in one way or the other. He would have been a centralizing authority. I don't think he would have resisted the temptation and would have been able to resist. If the ring of power was there and he was still there, he would have been able to wear it and he would have been able to, as you were saying, you know, he did have some kind of executive personality to him. You know, he wanted shit done in Bitcoin, so he would code it and he would put it out and he would change it. And I can imagine if he'd stuck around for another 10 years, I mean, think about all of the things that have come at Bitcoin. Think about all the ideas and all the suggestions. I don't think if he'd stuck around, he would have done as good a job. He could have possibly resisted the siren song of interventionism as well as he has by disappearing. And I don't know why he's disappeared or how or who he is, obviously, but I think the disappearance is really the magic ingredient which no altcoin can recreate. I think, you know, this is really the thing that gave Bitcoin this supernatural decentralization. And it's something that, you know, we've seen in action. We've had Bitcoin. We've seen Tarzan go into the jungle 10 years ago. Here he is 10 years later, thriving, strong, happy, healthy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he survived 10 years of the jungle. And we know that his caretaker is not here. So I don't think any altcoin can recreate that.
Yeah, I think it's tempting to ascribe moral consequence to action, but I think the tough thing about that is, you know, you really don't know, if, you know, what Satoshi's motivation was, right? I think that's the interesting thing about the Satoshi, the myth, right? Satoshi becomes this thing that we can ascribe all these different qualities to, right? So you have this idea of, you know, if you're a child who's grown up without a father, right, you're going to have, when you're younger, sort of these visions of Satoshi as, you know, oh, my father must be out in Africa, he must be helping all these people, there's got to be some reason that he's not with me, you know, because he's this person of supreme moral consequence, right? So I don't know, I think it's a little bit tempting to see Satoshi in that favorable light, which is one of the reasons why I've tried to kind of go to the text and see what I can dig out. And I think that I think you're right. Like, I think they're, you know, one, he did make the action, right? So you can also, while it's tempting to ascribe moral consequence to that action, actions can have moral consequences, right? In this case, I think he did divorce himself from the power of the project. But, you know, I don't know if it's totally true that he had the same attitudes towards like user rights and freedoms that we had, again, because he showed over the course of him being the maintainer that he was willing to kind of act unilaterally, that he's sort of supported positions seemingly that would act like that, right? He encouraged other developers to kind of come and take his place when he left. And I think that, you know, again, there's sort of this one change towards the end of his tenure. It's kind of an obscure kind of thing in Bitcoin history, but it's called is standard, right? So it's essentially this proposal that he enacts that just disables. So originally within Bitcoin, you had the right to accept any type of transaction, right? So today we're soft forking in Taproot, right? We're soft forking in this new transaction type. Originally, like, there was no restrictions on transaction types. Satoshi seems to have assumed that transaction types sort of just spontaneously emerged in the market, and then the node operators would have made independent decisions to accept those transactions if they were economically consequential to them. So again, why this is kind of an interesting thing to look at is originally in Bitcoin, we have this idea that, you know, seemingly all the nodes can accept any type of transactions, and any person who wants to create any type of transaction can also do that as long as it's economically viable. Kind of interesting. And then sort of when faced with the security problems that Bitcoin might face, right, this is a huge attack vector. People can just create arbitrary type new types of transactions that can lead to sort of all types of extreme negative security consequences. And kind of faced with the option to rescind this user freedom, he does rescind this freedom, right? So he actually enacts this policy rule called is standard, which again restricts which transaction types we can arrive at, which is today why we need something like Taproot, right? We need the developers to actually propose code that makes it okay for us to have a new transaction type. So does that give us maybe another more color on Satoshi as someone and his thoughts? I would argue yes, because I think that, you know, from that decision, you can kind of look at and see his reaction to, okay, what did he think of user rights and freedoms? To what extent did he prioritize security over those rights and freedoms? He seems to have made a decision prior to his departure that meets that criteria. Therefore, maybe he isn't someone who, you know, was as biased towards sort of free market, you know, type activities as we would have thought. Maybe he was more willing to make sacrifices so that Bitcoin could endure and, you know, still be widely used. And, you know, I think it's like more interesting to think of Satoshi as somebody who had to make those trade-offs, right? Because he was in a position where he did have to look at those decisions, and we can look at the decisions that he made. And again, I don't think that makes Satoshi good or bad. I think there is Satoshi the maintainer that we can look at. We can evaluate his choices. I think to the extent that that is, you know, something that we can do, I think we should do that, because I think it will make us more sympathetic of these things generally, right? Like, was it possible for Satoshi not to understand things as well as we do today? I think yes. That said, was he also a human being who, you know, I've said this before, like, Bitcoin is a tremendous critique of the world. like even whatever it is on technology level, to know you as a human being are going to depart this planet having made Bitcoin, you have made a system that is going to dramatically reshape, you know, most human constructs. Great job. You know, so I think you can believe that and then also be critical, or like want to study his individual choices and then have some nuanced view of them. So anyway, I support a nuanced Satoshi, I think is my
opinion. Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. I think, you know, time likely adds a nice sheen on actions that turn out nicely. Right. But I think perhaps in retrospect, what I'm trying to get at is that I don't think Bitcoin would have been this kind of anarchist, decentralized, immutable, users only, Austrian economics, hard money, purely voluntary system had he been around, not as a critique of him, just as a critique of human beings, because we have no track record of human beings successfully managing to successfully run something while at the same time not placing themselves in charge. It's an impossible balancing act. And I think maybe it's divine providence, maybe it's sheer luck. I think it was maybe his disappearance. And if he did do it, then yeah, it would have been the most genius move. But I struggle to think that this was deliberate. I think the Bitcoin that we have is different from the Bitcoin that Satoshi built in one main way, which is that Satoshi is not here, and that's maybe the most important magical sauce in this ingredient.
I guess the only thing I would push back on that a little bit is that I do think this like rights management part is like important, right? Satoshi didn't really leave a very clear way for it. Like Bitcoin needed to have some way to manage the threat of authority, if not authority itself. And this is where I do think that, and you saw this with the fork wars. The fork wars are essentially a huge drama about how Bitcoin should be managed, how developers should enact technical changes, and how those technical changes should be made with respect to user rights. And again, I think the fact that Satoshi is so absent from that debate and that his, you know, again, if you look at his record as a developer maintainer, it's so unclear like what his attitude was towards those things. I think I actually have a strong opinion on this, where I do think you have to view him as someone who didn't contribute to that. And if he wasn't a central contributor to that, then I think the people who did put in place the structure we have, right? So if Bitcoin is the only cryptocurrency where today it's designed in such a way where you have the right to dissent from the majority, that is like a profound difference. And it's one that Bitcoin almost didn't achieve because there was so much political pressure for it to squash that right. So again, I think some of these things are, I've used Satoshi as someone who again was unhelpful in leaving behind solving what was one of the central mysteries of Bitcoin, which is how can a system be truly decentralized when it, you know, it does have existing authority structures or benefits from authority structures that help propagate it. And because of that, I think I'm more willing to sort of say that, and this is viewed through the prism of the fork wars, where again, I think we really did come close to seeing Bitcoin become something different, or, you know, I don't even know if that's the right way to phrase it, right? There was so much disagreement at that time. And again, he was such an absent person from that debate, just in that, you know, nothing that he had provided really added to it other than his absence. I don't know. It's tough. You can argue it all sorts of different ways. I think I ultimately come to thinking that, you know, the way we manage upgrades within Bitcoin is so different than the rest of the cryptocurrencies. The way that that upgrade process ensures user rights is so different than other cryptocurrencies. And since Satoshi wasn't a principal participant in that, I think he is, you know, probably one of other contributors who I would say created Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin was created through a process of understanding that. I don't know if Bitcoin was completed by him.
Would you like to specify a few of these you think that contributed to this, or would you rather leave them nameless? It's up to you.
Yeah, sure. No, happy to. I mean, so I can list of people who I think that I've kind of, you know, dug through the archives and think have interesting places within history. I think Greg Maxwell is one that I think, you know, contributed pretty greatly. Adam Back, I already referenced in this conversation. There are lesser people who aren't as well known. Thamos, I think, is someone who's a really big contributor to Bitcoin intellectually. There's also Mircea Popescu, who I wrote an obituary about.
Yes, I was going to get to Mircea. Yeah, that was my next question.
Has passed away earlier this year, who I do think was really critical to this right to dissent, like for actually arguing that within Bitcoin, the user needed to be able to reject changes from the majority in order for Bitcoin to still be Bitcoin. I think Mircea is probably the most underrated, I think, of anybody who contributed to Bitcoin. But I think that would be a short list. I mean, I don't know. Again, this is sort of something that through my work, I'm sort of trying to approach the archives and identify people. But I'd say those four were a good cross-section of all people I think meaningfully contributed.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent segue to my next question, which is Mircea Popescu. You were researching him before he passed away. So this is a a Romanian Bitcoiner, early Bitcoiner, who was pretty early into Bitcoin and built a bunch of Bitcoin companies and was living in Argentina or Costa Rica or between those two places. And sadly, this year earlier, he was found drowned. Right. Off the coast of Costa Rica. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Yeah. So fascinating character, as I mentioned. I sort of release periodically these sort of, Bitcoin history type articles. My next piece that I'm working on is about the life of Mircea Popescu. He's a very interesting character within the Bitcoin history. I think you can characterize him in a lot of different ways. He's an early Bitcoin entrepreneur. He's someone who, pushed the limits very early on of what could happen within Bitcoin financial products. He ran an exchange where, this was essentially a Bitcoin stock exchange. He sort of becomes a prominent member during this period where it's kind of funny to think back now, but there was almost this sort of like pseudo Bitcoin shitcoining type phase where people were launching companies, like they had whole stock exchanges, they were buying and selling shares of companies priced in Bitcoin. They were batching these companies into ETF-like products. There was, almost credit default type of products that were being sold on these things. So you had this amazing like sort of period of financial innovation where, Mircea sort of emerges as someone who is unwilling to tolerate scammers or people who don't meet his, criteria for that, right? So he emerges as someone who is willing to, I think, look out for the rights of users by making an exchange that's a bit harder to use. You needed to have a registered PGP key. You needed to sort of have a trust relationship with other members. And it sort of develops, I think, the social etiquette that has become really common in Bitcoin today, where we adopt a more aggressive or assertive or acerbic, attacks on scammers and use that to educate the public, right? So he was really formative in that. So early on with his exchange, both in how it was constructed, it was a meaningful critique of what was going on at the time. But also, in his social attitude, he did, call out early projects like Ripple, which is now XRP, and Bitcoin Savings to Trust, which was a huge Ponzi scheme that he rightfully identified as a Ponzi scheme that later collapsed. So again, he's really instrumental early on, I think, in one, establishing the social attitude. Later on, he becomes probably the most prominent critic of the Bitcoin coders, right? So he sort of launches an attack on Gavin Andreessen, who's then the authority maintainer in the wake of Satoshi Nakamoto. And really, I think, establishes this idea that it's okay to reject the authority of the developers. The developers were not some sort of blessed class who had this, right to enact whatever changes that they wanted. And I think, again, he used this acerbic type attitude to undermine their authority, to basically say, you can't put your, just because you're a developer, that doesn't mean give you any right over me. I have the ability to accept your code. My node gives me, the ability to reject you. And I think, during that period, he was pretty instrumental in a couple of things. One was this idea that Bitcoin is sovereign, that it is a, that by participating in Bitcoin, you were essentially using a financial system that is on par with other financial systems. And two, that I think, he was really early to see that you needed to run a node in order to be a user of Bitcoin. I think, during that period, there was a lot of struggle about who should be a user of Bitcoin. The same way that, did owning a web wallet make you a Bitcoin user? Did having some Bitcoin make on Coinbase make you a Bitcoin user? I think he was among the first people to see that, no, you needed to actually run a node, that you needed to be able to reject, transactions, blocks, proposals from developers in order to exercise your sovereignty. And I think through that period, he becomes sort of a great villain of the early protocol days, where and there are still to this day there are developers who hate Mircea. They will not speak about Mircea. If you talk to them about Mircea, they will yell at you for bringing up Mircea. They believe that he is not dead currently, that he possesses enough Bitcoin to raise an army to take over small countries, and that he is the worst person that you could ever think of, and someone that they don't think kindly about financially empowering. I'll save the conclusion of that story because I think the third period is also interesting. But I don't know. He's a very interesting, I think, early thinker in Bitcoin, in that, if you go back and you look at his writings, they were very iconoclastic at the time, very controversial, and Bitcoin has certainly become more like he has described it. Bitcoiners, I would actually argue, have become more like him. And I think that you know, because of that, he's remains a somewhat controversial figure in the history, but I don't think that makes him any less important. I do think he was important.
Yeah, I must say myself, he was enormously influential in my understanding of Bitcoin. And I mentioned, I did thank him in the Bitcoin Standard. And I think, you know, after his death, I was contemplating, you know, his work. And I think when I was reading his stuff, 2014, 2015, when I first came across him, it was very difficult to figure out what is actually going on there. I mean, his essays are just,
he's a terrible writer, which is the funniest part of it, because he's a very influential writer, but he's also terrible at writing. He's like very laborious to read. There's like tons of references to other things. Right. Yeah. He's hard to actually read.
Absolutely. And he's, and I mean, his essays are just enormous long diatribes with an enormous number of tangential references, conclusions in Romanian, and obscure references to an endless number of obscure films. And it's just, it becomes very difficult to follow after a while, because, you know, I do have better things to do about the 1980s Romanian pornography and how it explains Bitcoin. But if you do slug through, if you try and follow the references, there's an enormous amount of value. And I, you know, more than I've been thinking about it, I think he was very instrumental, not just for me, but for a lot of people, in clarifying this idea that Bitcoin actually is, as you said, if you run a Bitcoin node, that's it. You do what you want with your node. Nobody can control you. And this, I think, it was hugely important, A, from a social perspective. People got to really understand and appreciate the value proposition of Bitcoin. Because, you know, for somebody like me, up until I came across this weird character on the internet, essentially proclaiming to be the emperor of Bitcoin, and his only claim to power is that he's not going to change anything about his node while right. other people are going to change it, and him winning every time, that was what drove the point home for them. Really, I think Bitcoin was a curiosity for me, and I didn't quite get it, and I didn't understand it. And in my mind, Bitcoin was watching points up until I read Mirsha, I would say. Up until I read Pescu, I thought Bitcoin was like what shitcoins are today. You know, you've got a group of people, and a group of programmers who are trying to reinvent money. And, you know, it's just a matter of waiting for the inevitable accidental implosion to happen, accidental or non-accidental, or for the government to shut them down. But and, you know, when you hear people like Gavin Andreessen, and when you hear a lot of the early evangelists for Bitcoin, you will kind of get that feel. You know, it feels a little bit like a, you know, an activist project. If we're going to go and bring financial inclusion to people, and we're going to be working on, you know, bringing down credit card fees, it sounds a little bit like a political campaign. And, you know, a lot of these evangelists have the attitude of, you know, let me explain to you why Bitcoin is great, and we are going to need you to come and help us to make Bitcoin work. And Mirsha's completely opposite attitude of fuck you, basically. Fuck you. And if you can run your own node, and if you can go through all of these things, then maybe I can talk to you. But other than that, you know, I have my own node. I'm sovereign. I have money that I can send all over the world, and I don't need to talk to any of the internet peasants. And this kind of attitude, the idea that this was not a fun game. It was not a kind of, you know, political activism where a bunch of hippies are going to try and petition their way into introducing a Fed substitute. That this is actually just working technology that's out there. And what this guy makes you realize in a very vivid sense, because of his extremely shocking and aggressive and profoundly offensive style, is it still works. You know, you can be the most politically incorrect asshole, and it's not clear how much of what he used to say he actually meant, and how much of it was shock value. And I don't have strong opinions on that, because I my eyes just blaze over when he gets into these kind of diatribes. But still, the fact that he could, I think, you know, the most telling part, which you referred to, is that in 2015, 16, and 17, as all these fork wars were happening, he basically, by just continuing to post his regular bullshit on his blog, he basically won all of these wars against all the Bitcoin influencers and coders who had all compromised in many ways. In fact, you know, if you look at all the early Bitcoiners, they were more or less all on board with SegWit2x. A lot of the early Bitcoiners, a lot of the influential Bitcoiners, whether it's the coders or obviously not all the coders, you know, Greg Maxwell, Adam Back. Yeah, but a lot of the entrepreneurs, a lot of the early hodlers, you know, Roger Ver, a lot of those people, Gavin Andreessen, they all went along with the SegWit2x. And by any ordinary measure of power, popularity, and traditional metrics of how things run in fiat world, SegWit2x should have won, and people like Mircea Popescu would have been left with nothing. And that the fact that essentially his and one very interesting tidbit, I think, is that he had his own he had his own implementation. He didn't use core software. He didn't use Bitcoin Core. He used something he called the Bitcoin Foundation client, which essentially
still maintained to today, actually.
Yeah, it's still maintained, and it doesn't do SegWit. It doesn't do all sorts of things that Bitcoin Core does. And he's been continuing to use this with very, very little changes. And, you know, his coins still work as well as anybody else. So I think for me personally, he was absolutely instrumental in understanding the fact that Bitcoin is a technology, and it's a technology where you're a user and everybody's a user and everybody's sovereign and there are no admins. And that's, you know, we like to call it the cry harder, the underlying technology behind Bitcoin. I think we could give Mircea Popescu credit for inventing cry harder as the underlying technology behind Bitcoin.
I think absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of people, I think, who generally come from my disposition are anti-Bitcoin toxicity. I happen to be a huge proponent of Bitcoin toxicity as an ideology and movement. I think Mircea Popescu's particular brand of it is probably the least explored. And it's a sad thing, because I think ultimately, you know, the cumulative impact of his work is that I think Mircea, what he really celebrated was that you couldn't be disenfranchised in Bitcoin. I think that's what he really understood, is that, and I think Bitcoin toxicity, as much as it's maligned, you know, this idea that you can be assertive, you can be aggressive, you can be offensive, you can post pictures of, you know, pornography on your blog if you want, right? It was because you were part of a financial system where you could no longer be disenfranchised. And I think that Mircea, you know, he sort of, you know, I think he attempts to invalidate Bitcoin on some level, right? I think he becomes a big bad for Bitcoin, and he says, okay, well, if these people, I'm going to harass them to they want to destroy me. And if they destroy me, they will destroy Bitcoin. So therefore they can't. And I think, you know, did he go a bit power hungry in his celebration of not being able to be disenfranchised? Probably. I think that's what makes Mercer's ending of Mercer's story so interesting. But, you know, again, I do think that people have Bitcoin toxicity backwards. I don't think they really understand where it comes from, because I do think ultimately it comes from the celebration that here within Bitcoin, this financial system, you have rights that no one can take away from, right? And I think that he maybe pushed that argument to the extreme, but certainly I think you can see just how influential that's become. I mean, the people who have kind of followed in his wake, you know, cited in your book and in other places as well. I mean, I think that to me, it's a foundational argument. It's a part of Bitcoin, and that, you know, no one's been able to say otherwise, as you've noticed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of people come at this from a marketing perspective, wherein, you know, in fiat world, you know, you have to put on a fake smile and tell people what they want to hear and get them to buy your stupid bullshit. Because the vast majority of shit that people buy in fiat life is unnecessary bullshit, and they really shouldn't be buying. So you need to go out of your way to market it for them. But in the case of Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin is Bitcoin is not an iPhone. It's not a toy. It's not the toy that you want. It's the medicine that you need, as I like to say. It's a lifeboat, and lifeboats don't need marketing. And people who run lifeboats, people who are responsible for lifeboats on cruise ships, they're not wasting their time on going around and telling people about how nice and inclusive and environmentally friendly the design of their lifeboats are. They know that if people need the lifeboats, they're going to jump on the lifeboat, and their job is to just keep the lifeboats in good condition. So I think that there's something very deeply refreshing and honest about Bitcoin and about Bitcoiners that are just very upfront about this. This is the difference between Bitcoiners and shitcoiners. And that if you're into a shitcoin, you're promoting somebody's private project. You're promoting somebody's pre-mine. You're promoting somebody who has an extremely high influence on the network and who can change the rules. But if you're into Bitcoin, you're promoting a neutral technology. You're telling people about something that can really benefit them and that does not leave them beholden to anybody else. Right. And, I hate arguing on marketing people's terms, because there's something far more important than whether a message is popular or not, which is truth. And, this is a lot of these sophisticated shitcoin influencers who are constantly coming up with big-brained takes about, you know, why we should be less toxic and why we should be more gentle. It's like functioning on an entirely different level, where in their mind, what is right is what is popular. And there are people out there who don't think like that. What is right is what is right, and what is wrong is wrong. And popularity can go fuck itself. I think this is a character fault line between Bitcoiners and shitcoiners. If you're the kind of person who thinks in terms of popularity, you're more likely to end up shitcoining than in Bitcoin. But the reality is, you know, the people who go by popularity are the people who are loud about marketing, and they're generally the people who do inconsequential bullshit things like marketing, with my all due respect for anybody involved in marketing. But the people that are actually out there for the truth, they're the Michael Saylors, they're the Paul Tudor Jones, they're the institutional allocators who are not going to not going to care about all of these theoretical debates from an angle of which one is nicer and which party is speaking nicer. They're going to think about this boat when the storm hits, you know, which is the best lifeboat when the storm hits. And it doesn't matter which lifeboat maker swears more. What matters is which lifeboat maker can make a boat that can get you to shore. And that's really, I think, the point here. And I think it's such a pathetic display of weakness of character, where people go around trying to police what other people are saying. You know, Bitcoin is permissionless. You do not sign a contract to behave by certain standards when you download the Bitcoin client or when you buy Bitcoin. And you're not obliged to tell anybody anything that they expect to hear from you. So if you are bothered by what somebody says, feel free to unfollow, mute, block, ignore what they're saying. But I think there's something profoundly idiotic and profoundly detestable about wanting to police what people say, you know, going around and saying, No. We need Bitcoiners to stop saying this, and they need to start saying that. There's no such thing as Bitcoiners. The vast majority of Bitcoiners aren't even on Twitter. And there's no reason why you should be following or listening to people whose opinions you don't like or whose ideas you don't like. The fact that there is such a concerted effort to try and police the way that Bitcoiners talk about Bitcoin, I think is, I think there's clearly an ulterior motive there, which is that you want to get Bitcoiners to become more accommodating and more accepting of Ponzi schemes.
Right. I think that ultimately, that's why the market has of Bitcoiners has rejected that, right? I think how I'd be more empathetic maybe to the cryptocurrency group is sort of say that, you know, I think that whole system, it's sort of appeals to them in the sense that, you know, it gives them, you can find the secret. You can figure out how to work this out, right? If only you're intelligent enough, if only you're smart enough, if only you can build better than everyone else, you alone can sort of find the key, right? And I think that's one interesting thing about the cryptocurrency system apart from Bitcoin, right? In Bitcoin, you have to just accept the rules, right? I think that's what, like, you've done well to articulate, Mercia has done well to articulate, or did well to articulate, unfortunately, but that, you know, you, by becoming subservient to Bitcoin by following the path of Bitcoin, you can gain this greater freedom. But I do think that comes at the cost of this other perspective, right? With the cryptocurrency class at large, where it does seem to offer this sort of, you know, great intellectual maze. I think the kind of carrot at the center of that is an appeal to the person's own intelligence and excellence. Right? Because to believe that you alone can go through all these cryptocurrencies and find the best for your portfolio, that you will avoid all the scams, that you will pick only the right ones. It does sort of appeal, I think, to people who I think might be susceptible to those things, right? Who aren't as confident and others, or who just, you know, I think are susceptible to paths where, appeals to their own intelligence, right? They want to be flattered by that type of process, right?
Yeah, I agree. Well, Stefano has a question for you. Stefano, you want to go ahead?
Cool.
Yes, of course. Hey, Peter.
Hi, Stefan.
Thank you. It was fascinating to hear about the history of Bitcoin. I'm somewhat new to the field, so it's good to learn about something from you. So my question is the following. As I learned about Bitcoin, I realized that the Bitcoin network is built on a very strong foundation, you know, using the blockchain and proof of work and so on. But at the same time, I'm also realizing that a lot of institutional centralized government, let's say like the United States or China, will very much want Bitcoin to fail because it's a threat to their centralized power by definition, right?
Sure.
So I realize that Bitcoin has been around for 10 years, it's demonstrated to be very resilient. But what weaknesses do you think may still exist within the network that can let one of these powerful centralized players able to either kill it or at least reduce its power?
Huh. Yeah, interesting question. I don't think I have that concern about Bitcoin anymore. And I think I would certainly appeal to people to work more to analyze threats to the network. I mean, certainly there's a lot of great people writing about, you know, issues with the Lightning Network and how mm-hmm. we're building it. I think Shinobi is someone who I follow who writes a lot about different threats in the Lightning Network. Alex B, another person who kind of take that threat assessment model. I think for me, I mean, you know, you can look at events like the Fork Wars, you can look at the China migration of Bitcoin hash power mm-hmm. and just sort of see that. I think for me, I don't think that in its current form, the Bitcoin network could be susceptible to that type of event. I think governments, mm-hmm. as you've alluded to, I think they can take steps to undermine it, and they likely will. I think the greater threat, I think, is honestly in the co-option of the cryptocurrency system as a whole, because, again, one of the great obfuscations here is that these other cryptocurrencies are offering all these sort of bells and whistles, but they're really coming at the cost of a couple things. One, you know, that user rights are restrictive in these environments, mm-hmm. and two, that decision-making within these environments is beholden to political apparatuses. I think what you're likely to find over time, and this is why I've become more vocal about this issue, about how Bitcoin is different on user rights than other cryptocurrencies, because I do think governments will eventually realize that they can sort of co-opt these other cryptocurrency systems. And I'm not under the illusion that I think that they'll fail anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I think what's far more likely to happen is that the cryptocurrency systems are going to get bigger. They're going to gain institutional adoption. I think, you know, this is the problem with systems that have systemic flaws, right? Mm-hmm. Where they're not immediately obvious. So I'll give you the example of, you know, one that I've been thinking about a lot with communism, right? Communism needed to be tested on the level of entire nations mm-hmm. adopted it prior to where it was clear that, like, in a communist political structure, you as a user had weakened user rights and that it was a bad system for you as an individual. Mm-hmm. But that required societal investment on a really, really massive scale. And I think we should keep that in mind, because I do think with the cryptocurrencies ecosystem broadly, my concern for them is not that they'll fail immediately. My concern for them is that they grow exponentially larger, become mm-hmm. co-opted, and then become weaponized against Bitcoin. And I do think that the biggest attack vector against Bitcoin or attack vectors against Bitcoiners, right? Mm. You as a person for being in Bitcoin, I think you have to understand that you face a certain risk, right? You are someone who lives in a real place that, you know, interacts with other people, and your rights can be restricted. I think what's likely to happen is exactly that. I think when they realize that they can't attack the Bitcoin network or undermine it, two things will happen. One, they'll try to co-opt the existing cryptocurrency systems. And then two, there will be deliberate campaigns to, undermine Bitcoiners, the rights of Bitcoiners, and to turn the collective political masses against Bitcoiners. But look, I think the other thing is that there is a geopolitical race now, right? El Salvador is a Bitcoin-friendly nation. Mm-hmm. And I'll choose to go move to El Salvador. That's a beautiful thing, right? So I do think, you know, it's not all bleak, but I would say that, you know, choosing to be a Bitcoiner, I think, you know, you are, while you are going to be empowered by this technology, I do think that, yes, you are correct that we will likely live through some period where either the network or us personally face some sort of sling and arrow for that decision.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Very interesting point of view.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. Peter has another question for you, Peter.
So in the discussion so far, you two have focused quite a lot on current debates within the Bitcoin community and the history of Bitcoin. And it's great to get Peter's kind of bird's eye view of all of the characters and debates that have been going on during his time as a journalist. So my question is now about the future. Peter, what do you think the future of Bitcoin is in terms of how large it will become within the global financial system? Because there are some people that think we're heading to a multi-currency world where Bitcoin will take on this kind of digital gold role and stop there. But there are others like Knut Svanholm, who's coming on the podcast later in the month, who thinks that we are on a path towards hyper-Bitcoinization, where Bitcoin will become the only currency that is really relevant in the international financial system. And he also thinks that could happen quite quickly. Like he says in some of his books that he sees the path as being faster than some hyperinflations that have happened in the past. So I'd be really keen to see whether you think these kind of hyper Bitcoinization scenarios are likely, and what you think the most probable path for Bitcoin's future is.
Yeah, interesting question. Appreciate that. Yeah, I would say I'm not as optimistic. I generally think that the greater the human endeavor is, the greater equal opposite reaction from whatever powers will try to restrict it. And I think that I've been critiqued in the past as being kind of puritanical in this view, but I do think it's worth keeping in mind, right? I think Bitcoiners are on the side of people who are aspiring to, you know, enhance the freedoms and rights of others. And generally, if you look at history, the people who have been aligned towards that generally don't have a great time. Like, you know, you can go back through the ages and just find countless examples of that, right? Are we going to be the Christians who are thrown to the lions? Like, I don't think it will go that far. But I think, you know, again, there are a lot of historical examples where if you're trying to enact meaningful change on a large enough scale, you know, in the United States, example, you know, there was an entire revolution fought for, you know, to make a democracy form and to, you know, the extent that you think democracies are valuable, propagate that political ideology around the world. So again, I think I prefer to look at that we're early in this. I don't think that certainly we're on the verge of a close hyper Bitcoinization period. I think that part of that thesis for mine is shaped by how long it currently takes, I think, to have a sophisticated view on Bitcoin and the problems with the mainstream framing of cryptocurrencies being the default lens, right? We see just how much longer that it makes the learning onboarding times for these kind of things. So, you know, that said, I mean, I am sympathetic to Nutt's argument and other people's arguments that, you know, I do think when Bitcoin really happens, it'll happen quite fast. I don't know if we'll live to see it. I prefer to look at the scenario where we don't, simply because I think, you know, that to me seems like the more logical or possible path, right? Like what happens if we're wrong and this takes longer? You know, I just think that's an interesting counterpoint to put forward, because I think a lot of people just immediately sort of talk about hyper Bitcoinization as something that's going to happen very soon. And I think an issue with that is that when we talk about hyper Bitcoinization happening soon, we create and attract users who may, again, talking about time preference, this is something that Safe talks about a lot. Are we really creating long, high time preference or low time preference individuals if we're promising hyper Bitcoinization tomorrow? I don't think so, right? So like if you are someone who thinks that hyper Bitcoinization is going to happen at the end of December, I don't know what to say to you. That's probably not a logical thing. If it does, great. I mean, I'd be biased towards that for the reasons I've explained towards user rights and freedoms. But I worry a little bit about creating, setting expectations with people that this will happen soon, or that they should expect it to happen soon. Because I worry what happens if they don't. Right? Like, are these people only in it for Bitcoin because they think this is going to happen soon? I don't know. Are those the people we want to be biased towards Bitcoin? I'm not sure. I guess that's how I would answer that question. It's probably very unsatisfying.
I'm inclined to agree in general. I think the economic arguments for the hardest money winning out, the arguments that SAFE outlines in the Bitcoin standard are very strong. But how long that takes is very much an open question. And it's an empirical question. And as you point out, we're talking about an extremely profound change in the way that international finance works and the power dynamics of the world work. So we should expect that there will be a big tussle between forces on either side of that battle before we get to that hyper Bitcoinization stage. But
I mean, that said, I do see it as a plausible scenario. I mean, 10 years ago, would it have been possible for El Salvador, to adopt it, right? I mean, I don't know. Bitcoin is this interesting case where it seems to happen both slower than we want it to and then faster than we expect. So, I think I only like to put out that counterpoint because I do think too often, I think we argue the hyper Bitcoinization point, and I worry about how that affects the preferences and expectations of those individuals who are in the market, right? We're still coming from that mainstream view.
Anybody else have any more questions for Peter?
I have another one, Saif, if I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Peter, the question is the following about the framing of Bitcoin versus the other cryptocurrencies. So as I was learning about Bitcoin in the last few months, it was very confusing that there are so many cryptocurrencies. And then the way they really helped me to frame the context was that, in my mind, at least, Bitcoin is the only truly decentralized digital currency. And all the other ones are interesting technology projects. And so I see the other cryptocurrencies as basically buying a share in a private technology project, which may or may not be useful or may not be successful. That's just like investing in a private technology company. Do you think this is proper framing or it's not really correct?
Yeah, I used to be sympathetic to that framing. I think at points I probably had adopted it myself. I think at this point, I would probably say that I think most cryptocurrency projects are just competing with Bitcoin on time preference. They're offering you some feature that Bitcoin doesn't have now, claiming that people will need it in the future. And I think the problem that I was bringing up in this article is that freedom is sort of an illusion because it's coming at the cost of like you having weaker rights than you would in the Bitcoin system. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately, if you think that the Bitcoin system is a financial system that can expand exponentially depending on consensual human progress, as say, sort of said earlier, I really liked how we used the word consent. I do think that Bitcoin is a consent-based financial system at its heart. If you attempt to define Bitcoin any more, in a more finite way than that, I would argue that you're probably have some, misaligned vision of the project, right? I think the people who tried to brand Bitcoin as a digital gold, I think it was well-intentioned. And I do think, SAFE has done a great job of, really showing that historically the role of gold within the financial markets is very expansive. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that's how people listen to you when you say digital gold. They're just thinking that, oh, this is gold and now there's Bitcoin, when really Bitcoin is a financial system that can expand as exponentially as the rate of, human progress, and I think it likely will. So that's where I think that, to the extent that other cryptocurrencies may be valuable, if they offer you some feature or service that exists today not on Bitcoin, then great. Certainly if you use some sort of lending protocol because you want to take a loan because no traditional financial institution will provide you a loan, I could understand why you would potentially want to do that. But does that mean I think that those systems will never be built on Bitcoin? I don't think so. That makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Peter. This has possibly been our longest seminar so far.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, thank you for this. Really fascinating and thought-provoking stuff. And where can people find more of your work?
Yeah, twitter.com, Pete_Rizzo_tweet pretty irregularly, but when I do work, I usually tweet it out. Also publish my Bitcoin history stuff over at Bitcoin Magazine, write a column on Forbes, and yes, I appreciate the forum. It was great to chat with you. As I said, I think right now Bitcoin Standard's the only book on the shelf, hopefully to be joined by other your subsequent publications soon. So, you know, personally looking forward to the Fiat Standard. Love the parts I've read so far, and also Principles of Economics. So appreciate all the work you're doing. And yeah, it was great to chat.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.